Talk given Sunday, 20th May, 1973. Why is it so difficult for us human beings to live by love? Love in its true sense. Why must there be so much violence, so much hurt and sorrow in the world? And it is not just a modern phenomenon. It is as old as time where the history of man is concerned. We accept the idea of love, the teaching of love. We believe we know what we mean by love. And perhaps there lies the flaw. We believe something which is not true. Why can't we live in harmony? What is the origin of love? What are those fundamental transcendent energies which in their interplay, transcendentally, when finally manifest in physical life, manifested that which human beings have sensed, at least, and experienced in some cases as love? What is this origin? Where does it come from? Poets have sung wonderfully about love. The mystics, the great devotees, have extolled it as the supreme value in human life. Great teachers like the Buddha and Jesus and those like them taught love as no man ever taught and exemplified it in their own lives. But we human beings curiously have utterly failed them. We have desecrated that which we would like to be the supreme thing in our lives, associated with the very root of our true fulfillment and fruition as human beings. You know the Buddha's great teaching as presented in his terms, loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity, perfect poise, that transcendent inner peace and balance without which it is impossible to express love in its entirety without let or hindrance, in the right way, every time, according to the person, the situation. And the great teachers have taught love in very simple terms, using the language which was prevalent in their times. All the great religions have presented the teaching of love in some form or other. Not one has omitted love as a transcendent value. But there are only a few instances where the origins of love have been symbolically indicated. The Upanishads are one example. And the statement made in the Upanishads sounds almost trivial, the verbal formulation. It certainly escapes one's notice that here is something of supreme profundity. I am referring to that remarkable discourse in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad by Yajnavalkya, who was known as the Prince of Yogis, when he speaks to his wife. He had two wives. He speaks to both of them, but the discourse is formulated in the Upanishad as if he were speaking only to one wife. Now, it is interesting to note the occasion when this discourse was given. Yajnavalkya had come to the decision to retire even from his forest hermitage and become a completely homeless wanderer, teaching and blessing his whole environment with his presence and his teaching wheresoever he went. Yajnavalkya was one of the greatest of the holy ones. And before leaving his little forest hut, naturally he had to make a settlement of his goods and chattels. Probably a couple of pots and pans, and the little hut, and some articles maybe. And he had to make this settlement between his two wives, Maitreyi and Katyayani. Now, this is how the discourse begins. Now, Yajnavalkya had two wives, Maitreyi and Katyayani. Of these two, Maitreyi was a discourser on Brahma knowledge, while Katyayani possessed only such knowledge as women ordinarily have. Now then, Yajnavalkya, when he wished to get ready for another mode of life, spoke as follows. Maitreyi, verily I am going away from this state into the forest. Let me make a settlement for you and for Katyayani. Then said Maitreyi, she is the Mary, the other one is the Martha of the story. Then said Maitreyi, my lord, if indeed this whole earth were filled with wealth and were mine, do I become immortal by it or not? No, said Yajnavalkya. As the life of people who have plenty of things will your life be, but there is no hope of immortality through wealth. Then Maitreyi said, what shall I do with that by which I do not become immortal? What you know of the way to immortality, venerable sir, That indeed explained to me. Now note Maitreya's request. What you know of the way to immortality, teach that to me. Now this is what Yajnavalkya answers. You have been truly dear to me. Now you have increased your dearness. Therefore, if you wish, my dear, they did use phrases like my dear in those days, Saumya. I will explain it to you. As I am expounding, meditate on it. Now this is very interesting. As I am expounding, meditate simultaneously on it. Be completely in communion with that which I am transmitting to you. Then Yajnavalkya said, verily, not for the sake of the husband is the husband dear, but for the sake of the Atma is the husband dear. Not for the sake of the wife is the wife dear, but for the sake of the Atma is the wife dear. Radhakrishnan translates it by saying, for the sake of. The Sanskrit text gives karma, which can be quite strictly translated as desire or love. So you can say, not for the love of the husband is the husband dear, but for the love of the Atma is the husband dear, and so on. And he repeats the same formula, going on to sons, to cattle, to wealth, to Brahmanhood, to Kshatrahood, to the worlds, and everything that there is. He even includes the gods, saying, verily, not for love of the gods are the gods dear, but for the love of the Atma are the gods dear. He includes also the Vedas, the sacred texts. Not for the love of the Vedas are the Vedas dear, but for the love of the Atma, the ultimate real, are the Vedas dear. Verily, the Atma, O Maitreya, is to be seen, heard, reflected on, meditated upon. When verily, the Atma is seen, heard, reflected on, and known, then all this is known. Note, he is not answering Maitreya's request about immortality. He is talking about love. Then he goes on to say, Brahmanhood deserts him who knows Brahmanhood in anything else than the Atma. Kshatriyahood deserts him who knows Kshatriyahood in anything else than the Atma. Kshatriyahood means the dignity or the office which one has by virtue of belonging to the Kshatriya, that is the ruling class, the warrior class, it is usually translated as. But not only were the warriors regarded as Kshatriyas, but also all who were engaged in the administration of the affairs of the country, in other words, all who wielded power, authority, in some form or other. Authority. The teachers and the Brahmins were, the priests and so on, belonged to the Brahmin class. And all these belonged to the Kshatriya class. Your town clerk, your judge, all these were Kshatriyas. And he goes on in the same strain, saying that the worlds, the gods, the Vedas, all beings, Everything deserts him who knows all this in anything other than the Atma. If you know it for itself, it departs from you. You are left impoverished, deprived. It's a very significant teaching. If you do not relate every single particular in your manifested life, your external life, to the ultimate real, in every instance, it deserts you. There is decay, there is death, there is suffering, and so forth. This is one of the important significances of this teaching. Now, obviously, he has not answered Maitreya. He's talked about love, and he's talked of it in this curious strain. How are we to understand this? It sounds almost trivial, doesn't it? And in any case, what need had Yajnavalkya to say these things to Maitreya, who already knew all about them, as formulated here, and who was his devoted wife and he her devoted husband for so many years? Yajnavalkya may have been somewhere near 60 years of age when he came to this decision to go into complete homelessness. Because you became an anchorite and became a forest hermit to start with at about the age of 48. That was the custom usually. Up to 24, you were a disciple of a Brahman teacher. Between 24 and 48, you married, brought up your family, whoever you were, holy one or not, and then at the age of 48, if you still felt that this was your real calling, then you retired into the forest, into a hermitage. Before you retired, you asked your wife whether she wished to accompany you or not. If she did not wish to accompany you, she stayed in the village. If she wished to accompany you, she did accompany you. But their life, after having brought up the family, was a celibate life. It was a platonic love only. See, that was their custom in those days. And then came the final stage when a man could go completely away altogether. Then he was alone. A woman also could do that. This is something not sufficiently well known. So now, the words used, husband, wife, the gods, the Vedas. Now the Vedas in those days certainly were not just written scriptures. They were orally transmitted esoteric wisdom. What is the real significance and meaning of husband, or shall I say, the deep significance and meaning of husband and wife in this context? And why is he talking of love instead of answering the question, or rather the request, to instruct her how to be immortal? In order to penetrate into this, let us look at an earlier chapter of this same Upanishad. And this is chapter 1, the fourth section. I have quoted the first verse often to you, and you know about it, but bear with me whilst we repeat it, otherwise we lose the thread. In the beginning, All this was Atma alone in the form of a person. Now don't immediately picture a head and shoulders and body and so on. Atma alone in the form of a person. What the word person implies in this context is explained in the next two or three sentences. Looking around, he saw nothing else than himself. Obviously, this is symbolic, because the statement is meaningless. If you are the one and only thing in the whole universe, the term looking around has no meaning. The term seeing nothing else than himself has no meaning, because you don't know at all what elseness or otherness means. And you cannot then say, as it is stated here, he said first, I am. Because you can state I am only if there is a you are. All right. Thence arose the name I. Therefore, even today, when one is addressed, he says first, it is I, and then speaks whatever name he has. We do that quite naturally, don't we? In most cases. Since before Purva, all this world, since before all this world, he burned up all evils, therefore he is a person, Purusha. He who knows this verily burns up him who desires to be ahead of him. A peculiar statement. Now, let's take that first verse again carefully. The teaching of the Holy Ones is given fundamentally at the transcendent level, not at the verbal, intellectual, psychological level. The psychological, intellectual expressions of the teachings of Scripture, of the teachings of the Holy Ones, is derived from the transcendent level, undergoing a loss of dimensions of awareness. Divine ideation, if I may so put it, is the complete, absolute, perfect truth. Coming down from that state of divine ideation, various dimensions of consciousness are lost, as multiplicity is gained. And so we come through to the intellectual, psychological, verbal expressions. Now this is a very important point. If we grasp this, really understand it, then the reading of Scripture can be fruitful. If we don't understand this, we can read for 100 years and get very little forada, if at all. So, the teaching of the Holy Ones is given at the transcendent level. The language they can use is only the dictionary language prevalent in their times. This is the difficult part of it, almost unfortunate part. Now, let us look at this again. In the beginning, always a wrong translation. It is a translation which implies time. The Holy One is talking of the timeless, unitary, whole state. Absolute. The one total reality state. The state of communion in which transcendence functions freely through the one in communion, the one in samadhi, in meditation. This you can picture easily enough. There he is. He is in the ultimate samadhi, what the Buddha called the cessation, what the Hindu calls the asampranyata samadhi, what in Christian and Sufi mysticism is the ultimate, the union with God, as it is called. He is in that state. In that state, there is only unitary awareness of the one total reality. There is no otherness in that consciousness. No otherness at all. The Upanishads, through and through, speak of the Atma or Brahman, and the words Atma and Brahman represent that state fundamentally, as being secondless, differenceless, the all-full, pure consciousness. Those are the terms they use. So you see, this is the state of being of the yogi. Now, coming on the return journey to ordinary everyday consciousness, proliferation begins to take place. At the first and second and third steps in that proliferation, what happens? The awareness of the functioning of transcendent mental energies, mind energies, which are formless and dimensionless, begin to rise up. He becomes aware of them. How is he to express them to his disciples? He has to find terms for them. So we'll see in a few moments what the terms are. Here as it is, in that ultimate state where he looks around and sees no one else, he says, "I am." Therefore, we get the name, as it is said here, the name I. This indicates what self in the ultimate sense means. This I, which is formless, dimensionless, which transcends existence or non-existence as you and I know of it here in our everyday life. It's a transcendent state. You can get the feel of it, you know, if you can enter into the quiet, the real quiet within yourself, and are not trying to seek for it or grab it, it will suddenly be there. This I can assure you. This is so. It will suddenly be there. And you will realize that that is the meaning of the word I. That is why through the years, time and again, I have said, there is only one meaning to the word I, namely, the one total reality. The totality is the only thing which can rightly be called I and the I am. And that is the I am, which is the everlasting, eternal real. There is no other I am. That is the infinite, the unconditioned, the not mortal, the not measurable. Therefore, the not sorrowing, the not confused, the not ignorant. See, these are realities, when you see it this way, that they are your living experience. So now, that is the starting point. But in order to arrive there, there are these sentences. since before all this world. Now, when he uses the phrase this world, it does not mean the earth or a mental world or anything that we talk of as a world. Since before all this world, the term this world refers to that transcendent state. Instead of, it would have been better if he had said this state of consciousness outright. If he had said that, it would have been less misleading. See? All right. Before this state of consciousness, he burned up all evils. Now, who is the he? The Holy One is talking of himself. He himself went through that discipline of complete and total purification of the mind and the heart. All evil was burned up. Now, the word formally is purva in Sanskrit, and the Sanskrit root of burnt up is ush. The root of the verb to burn up is ush. So, the teacher joins the two, pur of the purva and ush of the burnt up, and says that he who has burnt up all evil-mindedness is to be called the person, Purusha. Don't tell this to a scholar, because he will quite legitimately say you're talking nonsense, linguistically, philologically. But the Upanishads have their peculiar little funny ways in which to impart wisdom to the serious-minded religious. For him who cared for reality, and not for the niceties of intellectual discourse. Right. So this is the meaning of the word person. Now you see how sacred the idea of person is. Personality, as we understand it in our own day, and which we... the bulk of the world is so mad on sort of cultivating and presenting as an image before the public. Personality is the usurper of person. Look at all the personalities of the world. Subhumans. The whole lot of them. Those are the personalities. The person, the pure one, in whom all evil-mindedness is burnt out. There is no image presented there. There is no presentation made to a public there. It is just naturally there. Like the stars in the heaven are just naturally there. This is the difference between person and personality. Now, the next verse says, he was afraid. Actually, he wasn't afraid. This is just put in order to emphasize a particular point. Therefore, one who is alone is afraid. Because, you see, he starts off by saying, looking around and seeing no other than himself. He's alone. Of course, that statement, he was afraid, may indicate that he becomes aware in the separative sense for the first time. The first proliferation of consciousness is taking place. The self and the not-self is beginning to come into being in consciousness. And this is all on the return journey to ordinary sense mind consciousness, from that state of samadhi, of communion. Therefore, one who is alone is afraid. This one then thought to himself, since there is nothing else than myself, of what am I afraid? Thereupon, verily, his fear departed. For of what should he have been afraid? Assuredly, it is from a second that fear arises. Now note carefully that the teachings of Scripture essentially refer to consciousness, to what happens to your consciousness, the manner in which you are aware of existence from moment to moment. This is what the Scriptures are concerned with. If we are aware in terms of otherness, an other or others which are not in complete relationship with us, in our own awareness, we become afraid. This is the root of it all, the very roots of fear. I don't know what that is. I'm not in complete relationship with it. But if I give my total attention to that other thing, I am in complete relationship to it. And then there is no fear. To whatsoever, be it a tiger standing in front of you saying, "My dear chappie, I'm frightfully hungry," or be it your sweetheart approaching you, if you feel the complete communion, the relationship, there is no fear present there. It's absolutely absent. So you see, the Upanishads give extraordinary teachings in these ways. That's why people miss them. It is from a second, from the sense of otherness, where the other is not fully related to one, in one's own consciousness. Doesn't matter what the other feels about it, whether he feels related to you or not, or in harmony with you, doesn't make the difference. You are not afraid if you give your total attention. Then there is no fear. Now, the third verse, this is the important verse now. Verily, he had no delight. Therefore, one alone has no delight. He desired a second. He desired a second. Longed for. Karma comes into play. Not karma, K-A-R-M-A, but karma, K-A with a grave accent, M-A, karma, which is the Indian correspondent of Eros, the Greek Eros. These are the exact correspondences. He was indeed as large as a woman and a man closely embraced. Now note very carefully, he is still talking not of anything physical, but of that deep mental state, mental condition. He was indeed as large as a woman and a man closely embraced. He caused that self to fall into two pieces. Now the root of the word to fall apart is Pat, P-A-T. Therefrom arose a husband, Pati, and a wife, Patni. Therefore, this is true. Oneself is like a half fragment, as Yajnavalkya used to say. Now remember, the teacher is talking of the variations in awareness, in consciousness. What does this imply? That the unitary state is the state of the non-duality of the male, female, positive, negative, transcendent energies. Not merely of our world, we know positive and negative electricity and magnetic charges and all the rest of it, we know all about that. But this is at the transcendent level. The same thing applies. You'll find in the Kabbalah, for instance. that Yahweh, the deity, the transcendent deity, has his Shekinah. He is presented as the king, Macroprosopis. And the Shekinah is Matrona, the queen. Very interesting. And I mention this because Orthodox Judaism says flatly, Yahweh is an absolutely male deity, nothing feminine about him, which is slightly mistaken. So you see, at the transcendent level, these energies, these cosmic energies, which function when you are in that state of samadhi, are a non-duality of positive and negative energies. If that weren't the case, there never could be the interplay of these two aspects, the positive and negative, to give rise to a becoming process. There'd be no proliferation of consciousness. There'd be no separation out into this, that, and the other. This is extremely interesting. So now, this is the meaning of the falling apart of the person who was a man and a woman combined. You will find similar teachings in the other religious systems of the world also, if you go deeply enough into them. The Jewish presents the two as side by side. This presents the two as in embrace. This is just analogically, talking analogically from what happens at our physical level in our human life. That's all. Doesn't matter whether you talk of them side by side or whether they are in close embrace. You see? Therefore, he goes on to say, this void, and of course when he was talking to his disciples, he probably made a gesture. He said, he put his hands across like this, you see, and said, this void is filled by a wife, by the feminine. Now, this husband is the primary male. This wife is the primary female, the heavenly female. And it is important to bear this in mind, because in our own being, not only our psychophysical being, but that transcendent aspect of us of which we remain unaware mostly, most of us remain unaware throughout our lives, there is that transcendent male and transcendent female. And it is the female who holds the secret of creative power in her. And it is the transcendent male who specifically is concerned with consciousness, with awareness, an energy which by mere presence stirs up the transcendent female to create. Now, there is the realm of pure creation, the creation which has no consequence to it, no retributive consequence to it. Are you able to follow this? This is extremely deep, remember. And I'm sort of compressing it within a few minutes. This transcendent female is the heavenly female who really wakes up us here as psychophysical existence, TENTS, who wakes us up to awareness of that transcendent energy at work. Now that transcendent energy at work is perpetually creative. It's ceaselessly creative between the male and the female aspects of us. Here on earth, we are procreative. We misuse the word creation, actually, when we say that the artist created his picture or his symphony or his statue or whatever it is, or when the scientist or mathematician or philosopher creates this, that and the other. That is a mistaken use of the word creation. All this deals with procreation. Creation is perpetual, unceasing, constant. Procreation is a particularized process. Creation belongs to the infinite, to the immortal. Procreation belongs to the finite. Hence, that which we procreate is a finite thing. A person, a symphony, a poem, a building, anything you like, a meal, a new fashion. This is all procreation. And it belongs to the realm of the finite, the perishable, the mortal. You know, get hold of this, and you will understand, you'll get a glimmer of what the Buddha means, what the Buddha meant when he said, all this is anatta. Now, it is at this transcendent level that we look for the origins of love. This transcendent positive energy, this transcendent negative energy, the divine male, the divine female, in timeless conjugation, that's the language I use for it. And it is that which spells creation. It is that which spreads into space and time the mystery, the marvel, the wonder of the whole becoming process. In that timeless conjugation, there is no sorrow. There is no stain. There is no concupiscence. Here on earth, the earthly male and the earthly female are desire-driven. That heavenly female, which is also in us, is the source of energy which so stimulates us that vision opens out. And you get that vision, that understanding, which is completely beyond thought and word and imagination. Then the psychophysical being starts up, and the necessity for complete purification becomes clear as daylight to you. And in fact, you just become purified with the intensity of that vision, the transcendent vision. Remember that all these things have their solution, their fulfillment, their perfection only at the transcendent level. No sorrow, no difficulty, no confusion, no pain can be solved at its own earthly level. It's from a transcendent source that everything comes. The answer. The answer, the perfecting, the purifying, the realizing, everything comes from there. Now, here is the origin of love. This transcendent male and female within ourselves. We are, in fact, what I call a double duality. That is the transcendent male-female dual in us, which is always in the state of non-duality, in this timeless conjugation, this perpetual creative action. And there is the earthly male-female in each of us, which is confined to the finite, to that which is born, grows, decays, dies, which knows pain, sorrow, turmoil, and all the rest of it. And it is here that trouble comes. Now, this creative aspect is the most powerful, the most important aspect of existence that the human mind can possibly grasp. At the earthly level, therefore, the phallus becomes the instrument, the tool of creative action. This is the serpent. The serpent has many symbolisms. The obvious one, one of the obvious ones, of course, is the phallus. The phallus is the tool of procreation, not of creation. But the word phallus must not be restricted merely to the actual biological meaning of phallus. When one develops culturally, intellectually, aesthetically, and especially if one is born with genius, the brain acts as a phallus. It procreates the great music and all the beautiful things of the world. It procreates them out of the brain. A person who takes a pen and writes, the painter who takes a brush and writes and paints, that brush is the phallus, the tool of procreation. You see? Now we have forgotten all this. And we have, well, perhaps we never knew it at all. We don't know this. And therefore, we have become the slaves of the phallus, whatever its shape and form may be. And it's particularly, of course, the biological, simply because that is common and natural to all mankind from the beginning of man's existence. Desire-driven. Driven by the electrochemical activities that go on in the living body. But when one begins to see this origin of this timeless, of this conjugation and the meaning of the conjugative activity and process, pure creation, when one begins to see that, then the hold which the earthly, finite expressions have upon us, desire-impelled, disappear. They just vanish away. When you really see, have really understood, that is the end of all what people the world over, quite rightly, call sex problems. There are no sex problems then. The electrochemical process, the sexual energy as such, will not misapply itself. You look at the animal world, all happens in season, in rhythm with the universal process. With very rare exceptions, there are exceptions in the animal world too, but they are extremely rare, whereas it is so common with mankind all the world over. There is no such thing as rape in the animal world. They are all gentlemen and ladies, never misbehaving. It is we who have got muddled up. This is one of the meanings of the fall of man. There are many other forces at play too, but I'm just throwing out the suggestion for anyone who might be interested to pursue it himself. So now, here lie the origins of love. But in this state of timeless conjugation, what is the nature of that state? Take the earthly conjugation. It is finite. It comes to an end. It is mortal. But that timeless conjugation of the divine male and the divine female in us never began, never ends. It is everlastingly there. Creative activity. Immortal. Here is the answer to Maitreya. And this is the husband and this is the wife that Yajnavalkya is talking about. Now notice what he says, and it applies to every one of us, whether male in body or female in body. Therefore, this void, the word used is akasha, which here, of course, all scholars translate as space. They should use the word akasha itself. This void is filled by the feminine. Now, if you consider this matter very carefully, you will see the significance. The void, akasha, is mind space. It is not space in our physical sense of the term. What we call space, because of the activity of our sense, our bodily senses, the brain and the discursive mind, is merely the distance between solid objects. The distance between two objects, or more than two objects, is what we mean by the word space. Space as space, we don't really grasp, even in the physical sense. We don't know it. We cannot experience space in its own spatiality. We know that here is one wall, there is the other wall, there is the ceiling, here is the floor, this is the length of the room, this is the width of the room, that's the height of the room. Therefore, we say multiply these distances by them amongst themselves, and we get the volume of space, we say. But we don't know space. We have gone by a circuitous route in order to arrive at the statement that the amount of space in this room is 1,000 cubic feet or whatever it is. Much more than that, actually. This akasha is mind space, and it is filled by the feminine. Now remember what I said, this transcendent female is the one that holds the secret of creative power. So you see, this secret of creative power is a very deep thing in your own mind, which is in reality the universal mind, in your own psyche, I should say, that's better. You see, the secret of creative power is in the transcendent hidden depths of your own psyche. And if and when, through purification, through using your power of attention to be totally attentive, you let this energy come through right into the physical level, then that creative action, which is perpetual, which is everlastingly blissful, which is immortal, will bring forth the response in your earthly life in terms of a fully human life. And that is, as far as we as living psychophysical existent beings can know, experience, and realize, make real of immortality.